X-Men. In the 21st century, evil mutants led by Magneto aim to destroy the world. The only hope is X-Men.
Hello, New York! And now what were you going to do?
I was just going to say, hi, everybody. Welcome. We are at Cerebro Live. Cerebro Presents.
Eventually we called Cerebro and Friends, but that sounded so stupid. But we're like, we're not talking about X-Men right now. But yeah, we are talking about, in the Q&A, you can ask if you dare. But we're here to talk about, did you hear about Mimi Green, our Dark Horse?
Make some noise for Connor Goldsmith.
There she Josh is. Cornel. Here she is, boys and girls and theys and thems.
Pivoting into the creative field. Sorry about my voice. I hit Marie's crisis a little hard, and then we hit
went to the Eagle. but you know what? It's fine.
And we're here for a little pivot as we move from being X-Men commenters into creatives.
Yes.
In your own right. Do you two boys want to talk about how this project started taking shape? Should we tell the people? Because I assume not everyone has yet read it, so we've
But we are going to spoil, so you should have. If you haven't, that's on you, to be perfectly honest, at this juncture. Issue 3 came out this week. It's been like 3-4 days.
It'll make you more excited. You'll get into it.
You'll get into it. And like, spoilers are just hints as to what you'll enjoy most, really.
Right.
I don't
like
feel that way ever, but I'm making you feel that way now.
Where did it come from? How did this take shape? How did it take shape thematically? How did it take shape as a creative partnership?
So picture it. Los Angeles, 2021.
Already rough. Okay.
Josh and I, there's a whole book about it that I've written that you may have enjoyed. But so right after COVID, I was living in LA. We were doing the show. We were doing our Stacey X episode planning. And we started talking about wanting to do something together because Josh had done, he had some credits, but they were like one shots and anthologies and things. And we wanted to pitch something that was like a multi-issue story. And I didn't have any credits. So it was sort of, hello, Mr. Dark Horse. I have a podcast that people like. Would you let me write a comic book? And luckily, like, they were like, oh, the pitch is good. Okay. So like, yes. But we started talking about what we wanted to do, and we both were interested in doing a horror comic. It was right when the big like new horror comic boom was kind of starting, with like James Tynion was like exploding everywhere, as he should. Incredibly talented guy, nice guy too. I was excited about the idea of doing horror with Josh because Josh's style as a fan artist was much like cuter and softer, and that's kind of what people expected. So I liked the idea of doing like a Matryoshka doll where you had like the cute Josh art and then we would like peel it back and there'd be something horrible underneath it.
Yeah, yeah.
So we started trading log lines back and forth, just like one sentence of like, here's a horror idea. And actually Josh hit on, it was like round 3 or 4 or something. He goes, it was a different name, but it was like so-and-so, fresh off her divorce, checks into an inpatient clinic and something there is wrong. Mm-hmm. And that I was like, okay, what's wrong? What is it? Why is she there? Who is she there? Why did she get divorced? What is the... And then I just sort of started bringing all of my own trauma to it.
Uh-huh. Uh-huh.
And then people heard about Mimi Green.
I want to ask about the art too, but I think before we get in, because like to talk about the art, we got to talk about what it's about. So like, what is this book about for people who don't know the plot, but more importantly, what is it about thematically? Because this is about a lot of stuff.
David Lynch once said that the art is the talking, and well, I realize that I'm on a stage talking.
You're on a talk. You're on a stage.
I've made the choice, but no. I mean, what is Mulholland Drive about, Tony? No, it's and I want Josh to speak too. So just cut me off.
I'm in it. Don't worry.
Okay. I just know that if I don't say like shut me up,
that's my job. I'll shut you up.
Thank you. Please,
I've got the taser. I've got the snipers in place. So don't worry.
So I was thinking about like why did she check herself into rehab? What is this all about? We were just coming off the lockdowns, right? And there was that moment, like I know like cancel culture is this like very overblown concept that like a lot of people use to try and skirt accountability for anything they've ever done. But,
in such cases.
Yes. Yeah. But I do think it's also real, right? Like two things can be true. Like it could be something that people are using as like an, oh my God, I shouldn't be in trouble for having like done this horrible thing. But it was also true that particularly during the lockdowns, we all had nothing to do but be online, like sifting through each other's social media feeds and finding like the stupid thing you said when you were 20 and like blasting like this you like blasting it to the entire internet. Like, and there was this very bizarre sequence of events that really stuck with me where like the food writer Allison Roman got like mega canceled because she said something insulting at Chrissy Teigen's Home Goods line.
Yeah.
And now it vibed weird because she had also said something kind of dismissive about Marie Kondo in the same interview. And people were like, they're both Asian. That's weird. And she was like, okay, I was not thinking about that, but I apologize. But like, it was a whole thing. And she like lost her New York Times column because Chrissy Teigen was like the internet celebrity at the time.
Everyone's
but
mom.
Then like 3 months later, Chrissy Teigen got canceled for telling Courtney Stodden to kill herself in DMs. So like, it was just very, and so the snake was really eating its own tail. And I started having this idea of like, okay, I also, like, I used to be a literary agent for many years, and I worked in celebrity memoir, and so I had, like, kind of a front row seat occasionally to, like, a celebrity getting this treatment. And I found that while someone, like, you know, we're like, well, cancel culture's not real. Louis C.K. has a new special or whatever. But when it happens to women, it usually is real, at least for a longer period of time. And it does sort of become this, like, lottery style, scarlet letter style, like, this is America's whore who we must destroy. I wanted to get at that. So it came out of that. So the book is about a writer, New York Times bestselling author, et cetera. She's an essayist, but she's also like an Instagram influencer because now you have to do that also if you want to be. And so this was also kind of about me becoming a public
yourself? Not
person.
At all. Yeah,
right?
sure.
But I decided pretty quickly that like what I thought she should be, I didn't want it to be like she said something racist, because like I didn't want it to, you know, I wanted it to be something where, and you never see what she said in the comic, you never will in all four issues, because I don't want it to be about did she deserve this,
right?
It's like, okay, she said
you deny our ability to weigh in,
right? Like, I don't want the discourse to be like, is this bitch like the worst person in the world? It's like,
yes.
Okay,
yes she is,
yes she is, so I love her anyway, right? And so it's this thing where I wanted the discourse to be about, like, even if someone does. So we made it a fat phobia thing because I, since 2017, have lost 200 pounds. So that's been a very, like, personal. I mean, if you that may unlock this comic for a lot of people if they didn't know that about me. But, like, a lot of the things that Mimi talks about that she's like, it's not fair that anyone thinks I'm fat phobic because I used to be fat. I just lie about it. Right. And I'm like, okay, well, you know, like if you don't tell people, then they're not going to assume you're speaking from a place of personal experience.
I guess it's this, that's kind of like, because for everything you've been saying about like cancel culture and the way the internet has all made us insane, I think it's surprising to then hear this is a body horror comic, right? Because then you need that other piece to get there. And Josh, I feel like everyone is used to your art being the cutest damn thing we've ever seen in our lives. And then here you are scaring the shit out of me in this book. Like, what did it mean to work on this as a body horror thing? And how did you adapt your style into that brief? Like, did you want to do the body horror and then the book emerged, or did the book sort of demand it?
I think that's another like snake eating its own tail, and that it just kept getting more and more intense. And I think for folks who have read the second and third issues, we kind of push, we escalate into some new areas that weren't even in our original.
I wasn't even in the outline. I just was like, I realized suddenly I was working on issue 2 and I was like, she needs powers by the end of this issue. And he was like, what? I'm like, they'll be gross. Don't worry. But like, because we had said, part of what's so great about his design and those yellow glasses is that like the initial thing was, she is at the end of the day just like a lady. And so it was like, how do we make this a character who like could be in Fortnite, like shooting Addison Rae and like,
you got to give her the Sally,
like singing at each other, right? Like, how can
you will be coming with a little gun.
Yeah, exactly. And like, but also maybe with a claw arm now. Yeah. Like, you, so, but initially it was just, we want this like very striking. And because Josh is very good with fashion and with styling these characters, I think a lot of it also is the colors. Josh does all his own colors, which most artists in comics do not do. And I mean, there's a colorist who does it, who's also an artist, but you get what I'm saying. so there's a lot of color notes in the script because I knew what kind of palette.
Josh, what kind of scripts are you looking at? Like, is Connor hitting you with an Alan Moore page, or are you freehanding? Like, here's what she's gonna look like.
I think that they're what people, and we've said this a number of times before this, but like every page is truly both of us 100%. Mm-hmm. The scripts have evolved so much from the first issue until the final issue because Connor finally got a chance to kind of see what I was bringing to the table. Same sort of thing. There have been so many pages that we've then kind of altered because it has kind of sparked the next part of what the story is.
We just changed the very last page because Josh was like, this panel doesn't make sense. What is this about? And I was like, well, what if this happened? He goes, thank you. That is better. And like, you know, there have been a bunch of incidents like that where part of it is after he had drawn the first issue, I knew what the building looked like. Like, I knew.
Did you map the building? Did you do the whole thing?
So there are certain rooms that are mapped, and there are certain rooms that change over the course of the story. It's obviously kind of
it's not really a mappable space.
right. Sure.
And not so literal space, but also a very literal space because we return to the same rooms a lot. So, I would say Answers itself is unmappable for me.
Yeah. And how extensively were you character designing your cast? Because you have a pretty tight. The nice thing is it's a closed space, right? Our cast is extremely
We have a small cast.
It's a chamber piece. You could put this sucker on stage.
Yeah, like there's something.
And it will be.
and it will. You think Stranger Things is lighting up Broadway?
Sure. Yeah.
Baby, we got the strangest thing around.
We've got the strangest bitch you've ever met. But
I think that does kind of just the visuals of it all. It was always important for both of us that this doesn't look like anything else on the stands right now, and that is just. I've always been kind of categorized as an artist who's not quite indie, but also not quite
house style
superheroes, et cetera, which is why my fan art has always lived in its own kind of realm. But I always knew I had this horror in me, too, and I'm such a lover of horror, that from our very first kind of conversations about this, it was always, what if Silent Hill met the Goop Lab?
Silent Hill at the Goop Lab was the log line.
Like, what if all the scary that I know and love met the aesthetic that I have really honed and felt comfortable in this kind of softness of it? And inherently, right, a comic too, we're not able to do jump scares in the same way. We're not able to do horror in the same way as a movie. So I think in setting atmosphere above basically everything else, above perspective and anatomy, that's for sure.
Well, those are optional.
Yeah, it's a suggestion at this point. but to have that kind of top of my goal every time I approach a page, I think for me, that was my translation of like, this is how I do horror and this is how I'm going to be on the page.
Yeah, I feel like if this room was like, oh, those two guys from the X-Men podcast I love so much are doing a comic book, I don't think anyone in a million years would think this is what the comic book would look like. Like, what
that
is it?
Part of the goal too, right?
So, like,
you don't want to do fanfic.
Yeah. What are your references here? Like, when you think about like the mood board when you were beginning this, you were thinking about Silent Hill. It sounds like
Silent Hill 2 in particular. That game hit when I was 13. So. Stop me if you've heard this. When I was 13 years old, three things happened in very quick succession. Grant Morrison's new X-Men, 9/11, and Silent Hill 2 coming out on PS2.
The big three.
They're all kind of here.
All three.
They are. And like we said that in an interview, and someone's like, 9/11? I'm like, read the comic. It's a bit. But that came out of Josh's birthday is 9/11. And so every year I text Josh, never forget your birthday. And we were trying to figure out what is it about Ashley that's really annoying. Uh-huh. And like, because we love, Ashley's our child. Like, that's our daughter. But like, it was important that Ashley actually be annoying. It's not just like Mimi and Tyler being mean. Like, also, she's an off-putting kind of annoying person.
Right,
she's Firestar coded, right? Yeah. Like, something about her just puts people off. But
it's also having a 9/11 birthday. People will come out of the woodwork to be like, oh, and my dog walker's cousin's sister is, of course, a 9/11 baby.
Yeah, because
like,
you always
they're
remember
in the group chat, I'm sure.
Birthday. But so I
a built-in slogan, never forget.
So I grew up in Westchester, where the X-Men are from, and 9/11 was it was a big deal. I don't know if you guys ever heard about it. But no, like, I mean, the thing is, like, people's parents did die in 9/11, like, at my high school. So it was just a thing where, like, it was like, oh, my God, she's such a fucking bitch. I know that her dad died in 9/11, but it's enough. Like, I heard the school nurse once say on the phone to someone, she was like, I realize her father died in 9/11, but that doesn't give her an excuse to be a bitch to me. And I've thought about that kind of my entire, because this was very shortly after. Like, it was only like, it was like 2 years later that this
I was going to say, it maybe does give you permission to
I
be a
agree.
Bitch.
I agree.
For
and
a little bit.
I'm not going to say her name, but I personally thought she had every right to be kind of a bitch for a minute. But, you know, so we were actually at James Tynan's apartment after FlameCon. It was like he had a thing after FlameCon, the year that Tiny Onion, you were there, I think. Yeah.
I was also there. Yeah.
And I don't drink
I was
anymore,
in the room.
But at the time I was very drunk and I said to Josh suddenly, because we were talking about his birthday because it was coming up, and I was like, what if the thing that Ashley can't stop talking about is that her dad died in 9/11 and it's like enough already? It's been 25 years. Like, we're over it. Because the thing is, like, if it happened to you, obviously you wouldn't be over it.
But the thing that this book is so much also about is, like, our proximity to fame.
Yes.
Right? And, like,
and that for Ashley is, like, what could have made
pulls.
Her important.
Yeah.
Yeah. Like, and it didn't.
Yeah. Why? I want to talk about, like, the internet addiction thing, because this feels like a direction culture is kind of moving us in right now. Like, Hacks is also sort of thinking about, like, you were too online and it ruined your life.
I was
right?
worried people would think that, like, this was a Hacks rip. And when I pitched this, I actually hadn't seen Hacks yet. But now, also, like, Hannah Einbinder is, if we were to make a movie right. of this, exactly who I want. So it's like, and I just saw Teenage Sex and Death at Camp Miasma, which if you haven't seen yet, she is
it's incredible.
So good. And there was a Q&A after, and it was, I had the comic in my bag, and all I could do was, like, I was like, it would be inappropriate to try to give my comic to Hannah Einbinder. But we'll see when it's collected and trade.
I just think, like, it's less, they don't feel like riffs. They feel like these are the things we're thinking about right now. We're thinking about the way, like, that movie Octet was just, is in production, that was just on
the Ryan Johnson movie.
Lin-Manuel Miranda movie.
Oh, no, that's right.
But it's Lin-Manuel. The guy, it's written by the guy who did The Great Comet. Like, it's like Amanda Seyfried is like, the
what
internet
Ryan Johnson
made
movie
me
we were just talking about at the same time we were talking. It doesn't matter. We only have an hour. Never mind. We were talking about Tony's many important friends.
No, don't you. See, my family died in 9/11. No, but that's it, right? Like, this weird way we want to connect to fame, and this weird way it will scorch you to death.
Oh, yeah, because right? you can't win.
And along with that, you're sort of thinking about, you've also caught this moment in our culture that, like, the substance is thinking about beauty, like, the way, or just, like, the way you keep, like, every time I turn on Drag Race, it's like, well, she used to be a big queen and talk about a big queen getting the crown. Now she's got the crown and she ain't a big queen anymore, like, You've caught this moment where we're thinking as a culture about, like, the horror of what we're doing to ourselves.
But we're also at the end of body positivity, right? Like, that
is that
was it.
Are we just done?
I think it's over. Yeah. And, like, that was, like, not that I approve. I'm just saying, like, I do think that that's where, because here's the thing, like, the way that body positivity convinced thin people that it was okay to be fat was by saying it's not the fat people's fault. They can't help it.
Yeah.
It was not actually by convincing people that it's okay to be fat. It was like they're victims. So don't
right,
be
right,
mean.
Right, right. They were born this way.
Yes, yeah. It was very born this way. It was like, well, most people can't even lose weight with diet and exercise. Did you know that? Here's a study in the Huffington Post. You know, it was like a whole thing, but it was about, like, they're not responsible, so don't be mean. It wasn't about, like, actually caring about fat people.
Right, right. And also, like, all these icons who were the representatives of that, who are like, I'm so beautiful and big, and it's like, well, it seems you've returned for your All-Star season. And
well, but to be perfectly honest, can you blame them? Like, I mean, and this is where I come at it on a personal level, because, like, I don't know, I didn't feel positive. I was 350 pounds and I didn't feel good about it. And I had bariatric surgery. I am on a GLP-1. Like, I'm very candid about this stuff, because when people say, like, well, you lost, I'm like, I hate when a celebrity lies about it. And that's right. Part of what this is about.
Yeah, yeah.
Is like when, I mean, she name checks Adele and I love Adele, but like Adele did not lose that weight at the gym.
Right, right.
She did, because you do have to work. It's not like a magic, but like she had the same surgery I did, I guarantee you, and she lost 100 pounds, which is what happens. But like for me, it was treatment for binge eating disorder. So there's also like an eating disorder thing that really runs, because I could not control my weight. But the point is that like now that we're in this era where suddenly it's okay again, because like, well, you can get on a GLP-1, there's something you can do about it. Right. Everybody who like always hated fat people is now like, well, but why haven't you done something about that yet?
Right.
And that's kind of what Ashley is about in this, because like Ashley is fat and is like fine with it. Like her complex.
Woke 1.0 worked for her.
It did. Like Ashley's like really fine in a lot of ways. She's not fine in other ways, but like in terms of like there's.
Her dad died in 9/11.
Famously. But Yeah, and she's a drunk, but like, you know, and she's in LA, which she should not be. And like that scene where they're in the courtyard and she keeps trying to start the conversation over because Mia is not biting. She's like, what about this topic? It's like, yeah. That's me at every party in LA when I lived there for 4 years. It's awful. I mean, I love LA, but to visit.
It's so specifically about the sort of monstrosity of LA, too, as
a work. And also about being someone like, besides Natalie, who is from LA and is like a working class Mexican-American LA native, everyone else is a white person who came to LA for something.
Yeah.
And most of them came from New York, which I did. And also like many such people in LA. Like there is a Red Rover of like LA to New York. Right. And so
Josh, you were going to say something.
Yeah,
there.
Please.
No,
cut
no,
me
finish,
off. My God.
No, finish this thought.
My thought is just like, you just said finish my thought. You just said finish my thought. Do not tell me to and then give.
Oh, I didn't say anything. They're laughing.
Okay.
Did you know Josh's birthday is 9/11?
I do, famously. That's like
never
the first.
Forgot.
That's like the, if you had to like gun to my head, what are facts about Josh? I'm like French, 9/11.
Right. Finishing a thought.
You know? His boyfriend lives in my building. Coincidence.
Oh, well,
when I ran into him in the elevator this morning, I was like, I'm
addresses.
On my way to see your man. But anyway, so no, just the idea that you come to LA because there is something. If you are someone who moves to LA, it is because there is something wrong with you in like a specific way that is wrong with me, where it's like I crave attention. I need to be where it's Pink Pony Club, right? It's like I have these fantasies of like being there. I lived on Santa Monica Boulevard, which is crazy. I don't drink anymore. Like, you know, there's like a lot going on, but I also don't tweet anymore.
Right. Yes.
Like that. I'm also like,
these are all the same.
Twitter
these are all,
tweet,
these are
they're
all
the same
the
dopamine. Disease.
Yeah, exactly. Josh, think, you were going to say something.
Yeah. Well, I think what's interesting is we are obviously, I think the log line is very like social media influencer, cancel culture, LA. But so much of the book takes place in this kind of horror space instead of specifically negotiating with those concepts. But because it's always about consumption, they are ever present and it. Every time we like flash to the outside world, that is the kind of the contrast of how LA, social media, your own fucking Wikipedia page is consuming you. And then it's like smash cut back to Mimi and she is fighting flesh monsters.
Literally in hell. But like, yeah, like LA is bad, but it's such a relief every time we get back to LA in this comic.
Right.
And we wanted that by design. That's also part of the color story of it. And Josh does something very clever where the panels at Answers are horizontal and the panels outside of Answers are vertical.
Oh, I didn't
and they
notice
open
that
up
at all.
In
oh,
such
that's
a way.
Amazing.
Oh, Josh's layouts in this book are like nothing I've ever fucking seen. He's so
it
good.
Is a wildly
the one in issue 3, you know, the one with Ashley's dad, that layout is crazy. He sent me those pencils and I do write full script, but I was just like, do something cool with the paneling here. And then he sent me that. I was like, mission accomplished. Wow. You have done something cool with the paneling.
And are we at a hard wrap for 4? 4 is...
We're done it for you.
We're done with this story
is for done for
there
it.
Is a follow-up that we've pitched, but you all need to pre-order the trade paperback, which is coming January 12th, and it's going to be beautiful. It's
twice as good as January 6th. We will ride.
Way better, I would say, more than twice. This was very Mimi of me. I just emailed to be like, the quotes from Kieran Gillen and Anna Senti will be on the front, right? And they were like, oh, we already finalized the design. I'm like, that's so interesting because the quote should be on it. So,
I mean, we were kind of talking about, I will open up to the floor because I know everyone has.
But that's very, I'm like doing this prose event with Claudia, you know, like yeah, I need the quote on the front, please. I worked so
because
hard
Anna
to
Senti
get this quote
said,
because Annie Nesenti said something nice about me.
Anna
correct.
Senti.
Right.
Yeah,
so
yeah,
it's
yeah.
like, well.
Yeah. Well, that's the thing is like, as much as this book is about fame, it's kind of about how we've all been like, not most of the characters in this are not famous. They are just
right.
similarly fucked up. And
but
like,
we're kind of all famous now. Like, just like we're post body positivity, we're like post celebrity. Like, there right. are people like Zendaya who are like legitimately A-list famous, but they're vanishingly rare. Most of the most famous, like, you go to Page 6 now and it's all about like what people did on Instagram,
yeah.
people you've never heard of in your fucking life.
And
it's all curtains for Zusha all the time.
Yes. Yeah, exactly. And like, there's no one who can sell a box office anymore.
Right? No.
No one can open a film. So we're like all kind of at the same level of fame.
No,
like,
in fact, Zendaya
like
and Tom Holland and John Berthal opened the only films,
yeah.
and it was the
right.
same
yeah. Yeah.
week, and it
yeah.
was the three of them again, because it was like, these three people can open a movie.
And yet he can't open one by himself, right?
Like, no, you need all three of them.
Brand. Yeah, exactly. But like, it's a book that is about the way we're all sort of being distorted in these ways. Mm-hmm. I don't think surprising, given knowing the two of you, that our principals are women, which is interesting. But we also have, not to spoil too much, but we do have this gay character in the story, who is their own kind of, I'm projecting.
No, good slip. I love that. I like where your head's at.
Do you want to talk about Tyler? Do you want to talk about how Tyler is part of this sort of gay misogynist?
Well, right. So I love The Real Housewives.
End of sentence.
Shock. Yeah.
But here's the thing. I love Andy Cohen. And if Andy Cohen wanted to take me on a date, I'm a little old, I think. But actually, you know what? His boyfriend now is older than me. Point is, I would say yes, obviously. Take me to the penthouse, etc. But I do think there's something in like gay diva worship that I think sometimes is really cruel. And I think, like, you're nodding, but a lot of, like, this is not, you know.
No, you get it.
But I'm saying, like, there's that Judy Garland thing where it's, like, the suffering is part of it to us. Like, we identify with her suffering. But in order for that to be, like, an icon to us, she has to be suffering. So there's a consumption of female suffering that I think gay men, because we didn't see ourselves, we were like, oh, well, then I'm drawn to this, like, tragic woman. But that requires an economy of women experiencing tragedy, right? And so, like, The Real Housewives is one of the only things on television or in our pop culture that has any interest in the lives of women over 45.
Uh-huh.
And I find that incredibly fascinating. But also, it is specifically constructed around the idea of them all playing an elaborate game of chess for the cameras, in which they, like, compete for who will be the most popular influencer and, like, how I can reveal that your husband's having an affair on camera in a way that doesn't look like I planned it. You know, like, and it's all about these women tearing each other to pieces. And I just think, like, there's a drag of that too. It's that, like, we watch Sex and the City and our favorite character is Samantha, because Samantha is the one that gay men wrote, who just does gay man things, because you couldn't have a gay man on your show doing anything. So it was just like, we made a lady do it, you know? And so, like, I think what Tyler for me is about is this interplay of, he's introduced as, like, Mimi's little gay sidekick. And it's very clear that Mimi is very comfortable with having a little gay sidekick, and that she consumes gay men in that way because they give her positive yas queen attention that she lives on. But there's a twist. And, like, the line that ends issue 3, when I hit this, I was like, I've cracked this. He says, what can I say? I'm just more interested in female characters.
Right. Yeah, yeah. I want to ask you about Tyler too, because he is so much like a Josh boy. Like, you see him on the page and it's like, yep, there it is.
I think that was also especially intentional for his place in the story, is that he is the man.
There's only one.
He's the only man that speaks. He's the only man who we, like, even linger on his face for more than a second.
Besides that awful gay at the beginning who's talking shit about Mimi, who is meant to be resonant in that way.
Who is the Tyler of the outside. But
he's kind of the Mimi of the outside. They're like the same kind of sour individual.
Yeah.
Which he doesn't get.
I think that the story for what I wanted out of it was always female-centric. I've just done so many queer men stories, which is great. I've slutted up the X-Men in every which way, and I've hit the limit.
We're like, why won't Marvel call us?
But I always wanted it to be about a woman, and I think we were so intentional about Mimi Green's name in the title that it all kind of comes back to her, because she is the woman, and she is the one who is...
This is the girl, Mulholland Drive.
Like, she's having this story, and we were always very specific about the thing that kind of connected us to was, like, a character who is not going to make it out of this especially likable, and yet her story deserves to be told. She deserves to have this kind of spotlight in her... Pain and experiences matter, but where does the perspective of two gay men telling this story, which is about the consumption of women,
when we're doing the thing also, right?
A snake keeps eating its own tail in this, but are we consuming this woman in order to kind of get this story out of her?
We're putting these women through literal hell and, like, torturing them in the comics. So to me, it only made sense that ultimately the force torturing them within the comic was also the gay guy.
The gay man.
Right?
Yeah,
like, just is, because we do it because we love these women. We love them so much, but we love them so much that we need to, like, break the Barbie.
Eat them alive. I mean, I won't say which film I'm thinking of, but you'll know immediately. Like, a recent set of films that starred very like Yas Queen, gays love them, where it's like anorexia has clearly broken.
We all saw Dune.
Yeah, right. Right. Well, but, where it's like, and it's like, it's you're watching it happen. It's like, are you allowed to even say anything as it's happening? Because you're
right.
You're commenting on a woman's body
right.
again, you know, like.
No, and I you know, and I think that, and that's part of why, like, we have the women commenting on each other's bodies. Even like Ashley is the one, like, Ashley says in the first season, she's like, I don't think anything you said was that bad. And I'm, you know, like heavy. And Mimi says, don't say that about yourself.
Right.
And like, if you've ever been fat, that is something that people say to you all the time when you refer to yourself as fat or even overweight. They're like, don't say that. I'm like, that is a completely value neutral statement I was making my own body because it's literally true. Right.
There was an essay a few months ago about Mar-a-Lago face.
Yeah.
Where, like, it is.
As you were, Tarantino, right?
You were saying, like, the way body positivity had ended. And it's kind of like the ability to show your mastery over nature itself, to create the most unnatural face possible.
I knew some trans women who were pissed about that essay, which I thought was fair. But I was like, I don't think it's about you, to be fair.
Right,
like,
right.
Which is its own, like, you know... That's an oversight, but like...
Right, but like, this is also the thing your comic is so good at, is both the like, it's my body, I can do whatever I want to it. By the way, here is the way I'm thinking about the horrible monstrousness of what I have totally chosen for myself and which has realized for my... Like, we keep seeing like Mimi's scars like split again.
And I have those same scars and I have obsessive compulsive disorder, and that is something that I've seen a million times in my own head. That,
yeah.
That thing, I have that literal... It's like a C-section scar, which my mother pointed out, and I find that very interesting. But like, it's right across here. And whenever I'm shirtless in the mirror, I'm like, what if that just split open and all my guts fell out? Which I know would never happen.
Right.
It's just like, you can't avoid, especially when you're obsessive compulsive and you have these intrusive thoughts. Like, that's just, there's a line in it where she says, like, I gave Mimi obsessive compulsive disorder because I was like, otherwise, I don't know how she thinks, because that's how I think. But like, when she was like, scars are difficult for the obsessive compulsive. And Mimi's like, yeah, no shit. Like, this is the most useless therapy I've ever had. Yeah. But like, you know, I think that there's a... And now, me, your host, with a message from our sponsors. Anyone who's ever met me or just listened to my podcast can probably guess I'm not a huge cook. The idea of meal prep stresses me out. But that doesn't mean I don't want to make food at home or that I can afford to eat out all the time. Luckily, there's Omaha Steaks, who provide restaurant-quality protein you can keep frozen. Tender steaks, flavorful burgers, chicken, seafood, even side dishes, they deliver directly to your door. I've always been pretty skeptical about frozen delivery, but I'm very impressed with the quality here. Omaha Steaks meticulously ages their meat and gives every item the perfect vacuum seal to ship nationwide without sacrificing quality or taste. They've been at this for over 100 years and are the brand trusted by restaurant kitchens across the country. Honestly, it's like having a butcher or a gourmet kitchen right around the corner. I've never had an easier, more satisfying time building a meal at home that looks like it took hours instead of just minutes. Grocery store frozen meats cannot compare to the quality Omaha's been perfecting for generations. But don't take my word for it. Try the Burger Perfection Flight at omahasteaks.com today. That's 20 premium steak burgers for just $79.99. Plus, you can get $35 off with the promo code BEEF. That's omahasteaks.com, promo code BEEF for $35 off at checkout. Terms apply. See site for details.
X-Men.
And now, Miss Candy Southern, with a message from our sponsors. Have you been, Hepcats? If you're like my Worry, you might get a little nervous about certain purchases. But did you know it's now possible to get federally legal cannabis shipped right to your address? I'm serious. I remember a time when if I wanted weed, I had to meet up with some sketchy character behind the coffee a go-go. But Mood delivers premium 100% federally legal THC right to your door. And you can get 20% off your first order at mood.com/Cerebro with promo code Cerebro. Can you dig it? I'm talking about delicious high-potency gummies, top-shelf flower, home-baked cookies, personal vapes, anything you'd find in a dispensary you can now order online and have it shipped quickly, discreetly, and conveniently. Now that's accessible herb. And every Mood product is made from pesticide-free cannabis grown on America's best small farms at prices that won't destroy your wallet. Best of all, not only is every Mood product backed by a 100-day satisfaction guarantee, but as I mentioned, listeners get 20% off their first order with code Cerebro. So head to mood.com/Cerebro, check out their online dispensary, and discover your perfect mood. One last time, don't forget to use promo code Cerebro when you check out to save 20% on your first order. Thank you, Candy, and thanks to Mood for sponsoring the pod. Please use cannabis responsibly, and to our sober pals, you're doing great. Keep it up.
X-Men, X-Men.
There's an idea, too, that... Oh, God. Oh, God. What were we saying right before that?
Scars, obsessive.
The scars, and the body.
The choice of modifying your body.
Yes. Okay. So actually, and just to go back on the trans point, that a lot of trans women have told me that they find this book very like resonant. And
I did not realize Mimi was not.
You thought
trans.
Mimi was trans. I was like, that would be audacious for me to do like the gender dysphoria horror comic. That would be a little bit, I think I would be like, I'm swinging out of my lane a little bit on this one, but that would be.
She's just Slater coded like
she
that.
Is just, yes. She's just like very Slater vibes where it's like everyone thought that, but no.
Right, right.
But no, when I was having all of my weight loss surgery and then the post weight loss reconstructives, which are really tough, a good friend of mine was doing her gender stuff at the same time surgically. And we were having lunch at one point. I was like, I know it's like not the same thing, right. Obviously. She said, it kind of not, is, not, though. Yeah. Like, it's not. She's like, what I'm doing is like more socially unacceptable to people or whatever. But like, it is the same thing of like, you are not happy with the way you are presenting yourself, like gender wise to the, like, gay men are some of the biggest body fascists in the entire world. I don't think that's like a shocker to any gay man listening to this, but like body positivity never hit the gay community.
Sure.
That was not a thing. Like there's like bear culture, which is very specific. And if you don't like feel like here I am at the bear bar, pause up. Like if you're not into that, then it just isn't the vibe. Like then you're just fat. It's like, what are you doing here at the function? Like it was. And so, you know,
and you can be not fat enough for the bear bar. And then it's like, you're in a Twilight Zone.
If you're skinny fat, they will throw you off the boat.
Yeah, they're like, what is that? You're not an animal we recognize. Yeah, yeah. Like, right? So, you know.
Put the seal in the water.
So I just thought, I think that part of why it's about a woman is A, because like men are boring and I don't care. But like also because I thought that a story about a woman altering her body to be normatively acceptable to the eyes of the public, I thought that it would be more accessible to a general audience because we are used to thinking about women doing that. And I'm sure I'll get to a story that's more about like gay male body image at some point. But I thought that I didn't.
Well, I mean, not to spoil, but the twist is.
It gets there. By at some point, I mean issue 4, which isn't out yet. But like,
I think I'm going to ask one more question and then open it up because I'm sure there's.
Sure, please.
I think a lot of people in this room would probably be curious. As they've gone on the ride of Cerebro with you, with us, is like you're moving from a fan space, from a space of like on the outside looking and commenting in, into like a production face. Like, what do you feel like you learned about making comics, working on this, both at like a creative and also just like the business of the business?
I think this is relevant for you from like the fan to pro.
I mean, we've learned so much. Every single page, every issue is like 100 new problems, 100 new solutions. Even, you know, being able to chat with our editors about.
We're working on issue 4 at our table because we are overdue.
But I think that translating from that fan space to a creator space, I feel like I still want to be on the internet being like, and if you don't put Storm in a better Marvel Rivals skin, I'm going to get you all.
But we can't.
But I can't say that anymore.
Now, you know.
The other piece of that is just really having an appreciation for what has kind of gone into, frankly, the worst comic you've ever read. Like, the fact that somebody sat down and worked on this for dozens of hours of their life, that every part of this, there were so many hands connecting to it. Obviously, nobody intended to make a bad comic.
Right.
Many people make bad comics. So I think just having that understanding, that grace, that, like, I read comics with a lot more intention about what choices were made. I think I read a lot of comics from artists who I see make similar choices that I probably would have made in that scenario. And I don't think it's, you know, maybe it's not successful or this or that. And I feel like I'm like often now looking for things that I can specifically learn from more than even seeking out work from people I really love, because like to look at a Coypel page is like untouchable to me.
Right.
Yeah.
But to look at a different artist who I think like, oh, they like actually didn't nail that, but I can kind of take something from this. Or they did nail that, because I could kind of see what where their thinking was coming from. It's been like totally transformed.
I remember when we were working on the revisions on three, we went to see Backrooms, mm-hmm. and it was an interesting thing to see because it's dealing with this lot of similar like unreal space, non-Euclidean, like beige, in the same way that we kind of were in our visual language. And I liked a lot of what it did in terms of the ambiance, but like the way that I think that movie completely falls apart in the last like 30 minutes because the characters don't make any sense and it just doesn't land the plane. And I was in the process at that time of like, I was up all night trying to write issue 4, which was at, I don't know if
hard, anyone's ever hard to land
told you this
plane.
Endings yeah, yeah. are hard. It turns out it's like, and when I pitched this, it was 5. And so condensing it somewhat into 4, because we were pitching it at that moment. Remember when everything Marvel was 1 of 4 for like a year? That was when we were pitching this because there was a drop off at the time in the market. Any issue 4 to 5 was just like plummeting. So we did it in 4 and we got extra pages, but issue 4 was supposed to be a whole bottle episode about Tyler that's like, what's his deal? And so now I don't have that because I was like, that has to go. I don't have the time. And I actually, there was an interview with Zach Cregger where he was talking about weapons. And he was like, in my screenplay, there's a whole chapter called Gladys. And then the movie was already over 2 hours. So I was like, this has to go. And I was like, is this going to Backrooms though? Like, is this not going to make any sense by the end? And I'm hoping that I've landed the plane, but it's what Cregger said about weapons. He's like, I think the movie is better actually without over explaining what's going on.
Horror is, you should never explain.
You think about like Long Legs, another one that just
one that just really just like it shoots itself
because it just puts too much shit on at the end.
Legs too long, take the stilts off. I don't know what
legs
to tell you.
Too long.
The monster should never be in the spotlight. Like the one of my favorite examples of this is The Witch, where like the VVH. In the VVH, they cast the single hottest man you've ever seen to play the devil. They designed an amazing, like, Elizabethan costume for him, and you never really see it.
No,
it just moves through the background, and it's the most effective.
My favorite thing was reviews of 2, when we, like, the negative, because they, like, downgraded us a 0.5 or whatever, and I was like, and it was like,
not that
I just,
you remember or are bitter.
Not that I give a shit, right.
You've learned nothing at all about internet culture.
The point of Mimi Green is that it's still in our brain and that's okay. And that, like, you're never going to get away from it. So just embrace it and try not to be a psycho. Like, just be normal, right? But so we did go down
that's the point.
There's many points. But, like, I think that's what Ashley is basically always trying to say to her is, like, just, but you're crazy, though.
I was just kidding. I think Flesh Spear makes my head go brrr.
That's also good. But, like, but so we got a ding on one of our, and the reviewers also, they were like, I just feel like Tyler is kind of like a weirdly flat character. He's just there to serve Mimi's narrative. And I was like, that's exactly what I want you to think.
Right.
So like, you know, that's exciting too. The thing about a monthly is that like, you know where it's going and the people reading it don't.
The comics experience is always, and like,
I mean, you had a weekly.
That's
a kill myself.
Anyway, that's my own stuff. I want to kick it open.
Yes.
To the floor, because I imagine there's quite a few out here. Are we moving a mic around?
We've got one, yes.
Okay.
Thank you.
Can we start? Okay, we're going to start over there.
Hello.
Hi.
Hi. My question is specifically for Josh, because of
thank your... God.
Yeah, it's because I've heard too much of your voice, Connor. I'm sorry.
Yeah, shut me the fuck up.
Because I really want to commend your work on issue 3 and your work throughout the whole thing. Connor talked about your paneling specifically. There's one page where the panel is the hard gutters for Natalie and everything else is fleshy and it's incredible. But I noticed you have gone on such a wonderful journey from issue 1 to issue 3. I feel like your art has just elevated itself even as you are working on this process. So I want to know what has been the most rewarding experience for you in developing a monthly comic in which you're telling these different styles that's so different from your other, both fan work and your other like graphic novel traditionally published stuff?
Yeah, thank you so much. Yeah, I think each issue, I'm actually a little nervous that issue 4, like you look back on issue 1 and it's, there is quite a jump, I think, because I've never had this experience of doing monthly. I think this is, it's not the longest project I've ever worked on, but it's the project that I've had the most control over and that I feel the most precious about, which is why I am handling colors myself, because I know it feels like finally the first time I can hand somebody a project of mine and say, like, this is me putting it all on the table. versus feeling like I've handed things off to, I've worked with amazing colorists in my career, but they're not going to get my vision very specifically. Or I work with, you know, other people, and it's, I just know what I bring to the table is so singular. And I don't mean that to be facetious or anything. I mean that, like, I'm an insane person and, like, need to be able to communicate that. So I've every issue has taught me so much in terms of just, like, where do I push things? It's the reason that we're issue four has been both of us kind of landing the plane, struggling, because I think
we're building the runway.
Yeah.
Like, as we land it, you know what I mean?
And I think issue one, obviously there's so much setup there, so it doesn't push as far as those next issues. But then by the time I got to issue four, I was like, do panels even need to exist? Like, what if I'm just in a post-panel world? And like Connor said, there's so much intentionality behind the color palette as it represents what's happening outside, inside.
Different levels of answers.
Yeah.
The colors change.
The paneling changes based on where they're at. Thinking about things like, how does a jump scare exist in a flat page?
Like, with a page turn, how do you do it?
Yeah.
Or the thing you said about the gutters, that's in the script. But part of that is because after I saw what he was doing in the first issue, and I, because in the first issue, like, those nightmare pages, like, two of them are really Marvel method. Like, the script says, like, hey Josh, go fucking crazy, here are, like, the four panels I need, do them somewhere. Yeah, yeah, right. Yeah. And then once I saw the visual language he created in the first issue, then I was like, well, I knew that I wanted hard gutters around Natalie's panels, because Natalie doesn't truck with this shit at all. Whereas, like, Mimi's like, I'm crazy, you know? And so I wanted that, but I knew how he would do it. So then by the time I was writing issue two, I was able to be very specific and, like, this is one of these panels, this is one of those panels. But he always did something with those panels that I wasn't anticipating. And that creates its own language too. And so issue four has, a lot of it's been about, like, tying the bow on the visuals that we've created together. This really was just like, I think we're kind of spoiled at this point, because, like, this has been such a collaboration, but we've been working on this for 4 years and we developed the premise together. Like, that's unusual with an artist, even. You don't always develop, like.
And that was huge for me too, is that I think I'm a decent artist, whatever. I think that my strength
How dare you insult Josh Cornell?
Let him self-deprecate a little, but also do that. It's
no, but I think it's just the physical act of drawing brings me so much joy, but it's not 1,000% where I put all of my eggs. I think that for me, being a storyteller is, like, the most important piece. It's why I also write. It's why I do all these other pieces of the puzzle. So that was always so important to me in coming to any project. Honestly, anytime I've ever worked with a writer, it's because I'm like, I want to do this together. I don't love just being, like, assigned to something.
Right. Because if you're at the big two in particular, often you're just cast together. And it's like, we want someone to write Daredevil. We've got this writer. And now we've found this artist. Now you two, like, chat.
And, I mean, like,
even
frankly,
that
this
would
work
be
is
generous
too.
And fun. Like, very often the big two experiences, thank you for your script, we will now assign it to this person. And it's, well, like, if I had known it was that person, I would have written an entirely
right. You didn't
script.
Even,
like,
know which artist you were writing it
with. Yeah. Them, etc. Yeah, I think, frankly, this work is, like, too hard to do bullshit. Like, it's just, it takes too much of my, like, physical strength to do this, and, like, my sanity to do work that I don't feel excited about. I would rather have my.
You're missing your kids' graduation for this. Yeah, yeah.
This is our kids' graduation. Like, we were kind of like, if we only get one comic, we want it to be really good.
It is fucking good.
Well, thank you.
Okay, let's get another one.
Hi. Oh, good, it's on. Well, Josh, this is mostly for you, but Connor, you can answer a little.
I always do.
And you will, yeah.
In fact, that's coincidentally kind of what I want to say. you know that cliche about how most writers are, like, such introverts? Right. Yeah, exactly. I'm a writer, too. I'm working on a graphic novel, I was just telling you. And I am, like you, also super extrovert. Not quite as OCD as you, but, or what? What?
What's the question?
But, yeah. Love it. Okay.
Insult the rest of us. No.
I just
want to. What do you got about me?
So I know already, talking to artists, I talk too much, you know? And they're like, Okay, there's a lot of dialogue here, and I have a lot I want to say. So I was like, how is it for you to shut him up, you know?
We were just talking about this at the table. People keep telling you.
You mean at a page level? At the level of the art?
Yeah, and how do you handle that, too? I'm curious.
I think, one, in our personal relationship, we've gotten very close over the course of this project, and I feel very comfortable telling Connor,
like, shut up,
when to stop, and it's why I don't feel so stressed about, you know, you talking.
No, obviously.
And I don't consider myself, like, too much of a wallflower. I make my presence known deliberately.
He's very French.
But
you know when he's pissed.
No, I think one of the things that has popped up in how folks have talked to me about the book is everybody is very surprised that Connor is restrained when it comes to the dialogue.
I've gotten this note myself. Josh Trujillo said to me, he was like, I was really impressed with how minimalist the dialogue was. I expected you to, I was like, fuck you, but also thanks, because I worked really hard at that.
We've gotten so few notes from our editors. They have really just understood what we're going for, which is so, so great. But one of the notes was like, there's got to be like some dialogue,
on this page,
so that people aren't just like consuming.
Going right
through
the art.
Was it at the script level first, or did you hand in the art and pare it back? Like,
I write this. Tini Howard says first you write the bad version.
Yes, exactly.
And she really, she tore this script apart with me, which she's a good friend of mine. She didn't need to do that, but she sat on my couch and we like ripped it apart, and I wrote it all over again, the first issue. And the first version, it was chattier.
Yeah.
And I couldn't decide if I wanted narration. And what I ultimately decided was I don't want narration, because Mimi has to be opaque enough that you understand that people project onto her, and like you're also projecting onto her. Tini said to me, actually, Mulholland Drive is my favorite movie. She said to me, do you know that scene in Mulholland Drive where they slide the photograph across the table and they say, this is the girl?
Yeah.
And I was like, yes. And she goes, that's what you're trying to do, right? I was like, that's exactly what I'm trying to do. And she said, okay, you need to convince me that this is the girl.
Yeah.
And you do it by having her say less.
Also, I just want to shout out the other creative element of this team, which is Ariana Mayer, who you've got doing.
Ariana is incredible.
Incredible.
Yes, incredible. She's my favorite letterer working today. We met through Tini, actually, because she lettered Excalibur.
She is the keeper of my files whenever I'm like, Ariana, I need the M plate font.
She's got it.
Yeah.
And she and Josh designed, there's like the Crystal Sound Bowl sound effect that happens throughout, because I wanted something like Silent Hill when the radio starts going and you're like, this is bad. I don't know what's coming, but it's bad. So I wanted something like survival horror vibe like that. And so we came up, like, if you've ever been to a wellness thing in LA and you've heard like the sound bowl, it's like, it's beautiful. But also, like, if it kept going, you'd be like, stop.
Sinister. Yeah.
Please stop. Ariana was great with that.
Yeah. Can we go over here? Is that, and then we'll do, how do we have time? How much time we got?
We're losing it with you asking this question.
I'm just checking. Okay, you've got the mic there. Start here.
We're wasting daylight.
Love this shirt.
Thank you. I have a question for Connor.
Hit me.
You kind of touched upon this when you were saying like your trans friends' reactions to your work, while it was unexpected, you know, it was something that came about. My question is, you know, as a creative, when you do release something out into the world, you know, it becomes, the people are able to kind of take it and interpret it and apply it to their own lives. Are there any reactions that you received that kind of surprised you from this work?
Yes. I actually initially was surprised in the first issue by how much people really didn't like Mimi. And I wasn't like, we set out to like do an unlikable protagonist female character because those are the characters I love best. But like, it was interesting because it was, in particular, like I felt like straight male reviewers were like, obviously this book is about a terrible person. And I was like, is it? Or is she just like a real person who has flaws? You know what I mean? Like, I think that's an interesting thing too. Like, I was talking to Patton Oswalt about this recently, because a big influence on this book also is Young Adult with him and Charlize Theron, which is a movie I adore. And Mavis Gary, the main character, which actually coincidentally has the same initials as Mimi Green, but that was not on purpose. That character is wretched.
That movie's so good.
I saw it four times in theaters, and Patton Oswalt was like, that's crazy. And I'm like, I'm gay. I think it's her best performance. He said, I agree. He's like, I said, I think she should have been nominated. He's like, the only reason she wasn't is because the character's too unpleasant and they won't let women do that. Yeah. They just won't.
Yeah. I also feel that way about my best friend's wedding. It's like Julia Roberts is like, but that wrong. She's so awful.
Dreadful. But it's the Sex and the City thing too, right? Like Carrie Bradshaw sucks, but so does Tony Soprano. Why do we only talk about Carrie Bradshaw sucking? Do you know what I mean? Like that's what all the HBO shows were about, people who sucked. That was that whole wave of TV. I also am somewhat by design, and this is kind of also what the comic's about, like it is really bad for my mental health to see what too many people have to say about anything I do. Doing the podcast when it, you know, I was not the guy. I was an agent. I would be at events with the person who was the guy or the gal who was signing and all of that. And I was on the team when I started the podcast, and then it got huge, which I didn't anticipate at all. Suddenly, like everyone had an opinion about me. And like Twitter would say, for you, some gay guy talking about how you suck. And I'm like, You know, I don't need to like that's fine. Like, who needs 4 hours on Opaluna Saturday? I'm like, then you don't need to listen to my podcast. It's not for you. That's okay. There are many other podcasts you could listen to. You know what I mean? But I found like I don't read reviews. I read reviews of this comic when Josh sends one to me and goes, read this one. And like, if there's a negative review where there's something interesting to like look at, I'm happy to do that. But I try not to see too many reactions, especially when we're still working on the book, because I would hate if I changed something about it to please the imagined, that's what this book is also about, right? Is like the imagined, I think that we lost, and I don't think this is bad necessarily, but in some respects, our culture as a broader culture lost the idea of God as something that like punishes you. Like the idea that you will go to hell and all like that was for centuries. That was how you got people to behave. And I do think that as technology has sort of like, I think the panopticon, we've become, it's the superego at the end of the day, right? Like we are
Instagram is
watching.
My God and it loves me back.
Or it doesn't. Or it doesn't, right? And like that the fear is that everyone looking at me will turn on me. And that when you write a horror comic, you have to write about what scares you. And so I did.
There is that thing that like academics are talking about, the like paranoid Tumblr prose style. Where
yes.
Like, authors have become so anxious about,
you're afraid to make a joke about anything.
Yeah,
because out of context on Tumblr, you look like an asshole.
It's like a very crouched prose style that doesn't risk as much. Anyway, there was a question here. Yes,
yeah. I think One Piece 2 is criticism is also hugely important for
us.
And like a well-written piece that dogs us will always be more important than like a random comment.
Yeah, and I just like I try to not intake like too many just like random dashed off like, this guy just got a comic because of his podcast. I'm like, fuck you. Like that, I don't need to see that. It's not, and it's also not for me. That's not something they want me to see anyway, really.
The good thing about the book is that basically any criticism you have, you just hand them the book and go, yeah, I get it.
It's about
this
that.
Is about you. Yeah.
Like I hate myself.
It's like you're an attention-seeking megalomaniac. I'm like, do you want to read the comic? Or like what, you know? Like, I know.
I wish I was dead too. What's new?
Like, yeah, like, why? Like, there was, I will never forget some tweet about an episode we did that was like, the last thing I want to hear is two cis men talking about this female character. And I'm like, that is what the comic's about, baby. Like, I get it. I get it, you know? And like, we're still doing it. Which, like, it's a little bit have your cake and eat it, too, to, like,
sure, yeah,
critique yourself while you do the thing. But it's very Charlie XCX, like, I'm very self-aware, which hasn't helped anything.
Yeah.
You know? Like, that is really on my vision board. But I do think it's better to try than to not try.
I think people mistake write what you know to mean write only about
yourself.
Which is
100%.
Not correct. Okay, there's questions here. Kat's got questions.
Hey, first off, I want to say, like, as a fat person reading this comic in the age of Ozempic, where and the rise of former fats amongst us has been really, like, really great to see, like, something that spoke so personally to, like, I feel so many fat people in this era. And the way in which you, Connor, write Ashley and you, Josh, draw Ashley, I've had this conversation with so many fat people. So often when you see fat characters in comics, they're drawn in such a grotesque way. And the fact that like there is this really great character in a body horror comic where it doesn't focus so much on the body horror on her. As
the horror is not her body.
Yeah, the horror
it's
is not
Mimi's.
Her.
Yeah,
exactly.
Right.
I wanted to just ask you, like, how important was that to you that like in this realm of like everybody else like experience, like specifically Mimi experiencing that body horror, that Ashley's horror not be so focused on that?
It was really important for me. Ashley and Mimi, I mean, every character in a Something You Write is yourself, right? And like, so, you know, Mimi is, a lot of what Mimi's about is like, when you lose as much weight as I did, every 10 pounds, people treat you very differently, especially in Los Angeles. And at a certain point, you hit a threshold where you're like now normal. and you're invited to things. And you're like, I always knew this. But like, so I wanted to have the perspective of someone like, it's Sabrina Carpenter, like, where did all these parties come from? When did all you bitches get so nice? Like, that's Mimi's experience. But Ashley's still not invited. And she's on the outside trying to, like, get in with these cool people. But she will, frankly, never be cool enough for most cool people in Los Angeles. And that's just, like, is what it is. But I think that, for me, it was really important that if I'm going to have a comic that is about someone who hates her body and, like, said very nasty things about fat people, I needed there to be a heroic character who was a fat woman also. And Ashley doesn't think of herself as beautiful, but the way Josh draws her is, it was like, that's part of why I knew, I'd seen Josh draw fat characters before, and I knew that he could do it because Ashley looks great in every panel of her. And part, there's a bit in issue 4, spoiler, but there's like a flashback panel of Mimi dancing at the club before, and she looks great, but she doesn't know that. You know what I mean? And I think that it was important for me that, like, Ashley has a lot of insecurities about, like, whether she's, like, cool enough or smart enough or, like, annoying or whatever. But, like, she doesn't actually care that she's heavy. That doesn't, like, bother her.
Josh, I want to kick this to you, too, because, yeah, like, I started this being, like, it is surprising that two people who come out of the X-Men world made this comic. One of the things I think is very surprising is, like, the big two traditional superhero comics cannot draw a person who does not look like that one.
Like Tyler.
Yeah, that one layout.
He's the only one who looks like that at this comic very intentionally.
Yeah, I think that...
And you nailed it. And, like, what is it like? How does that work? How do you do that? Teach the children how to do that. Because I'm tired of giving the note, like, yeah, please do not do this to every woman. I need to erase some of the abs from this picture. Like,
right, yeah.
I think that
Destiny doesn't need bolt-ons.
What's exciting about that is it wasn't kind of in our initial thing, is that, like, almost none of our cast has a superhero body type. Mimi is explicitly supposed to be underweight. Ashley's fat. Natalie
Mara's fat. Natalie's butch.
So there's so many characters that required that they don't look like superheroes, which is what I had so much experience with. But I think it goes back also to that point of not an indie artist, but also not a superhero artist. It's my goal in my kind of ethos for my art is always the softness of, like, who real human people are. That's why I like a weird face. I like, in many parts of the issues, I'm not scared to let these characters look ugly. Mm-hmm. Like, God bless, like, a Greg Land, a Lucas Wernick, who can make everybody look fucking gorgeous all the time. Greg Land, love.
What? Josh is a little younger than me and grew up indoctrinated in the Greg Land.
Well, I think it's so...
He's a really great guy, by the way.
One, I've heard he's an incredible guy behind the scenes. And two, I think it's very funny to kind of full circle loop back to thinking Greg is incredible.
Well, I think gay men always kind of have, though, right? Because it's like, this is so cunty. But, like, that's exactly what we're examining also.
Right.
Like, that's bad.
And
that women should be Barbie dolls because it's fun to look at.
Yeah, and I think very specifically, like, if you're watching a fat character get exploded in a 9/11 style explosion. Like, I didn't want to feel like she had, and Mimi too, as she becomes this grotesque beast, I never wanted to feel this pressure that they had to look pretty, and very specifically, I think so much about, like, their eyelashes, as I'm like, well, they're not wearing makeup in this scene, so, like, this should not be a full fucking beat. This should look like they just got their asses beat. Like, they're covered
in blood. And Ashley's getting dunked in the pool.
Yeah. So I think that is a huge piece of it for me. And the other thing is that I love these characters so much.
We've lived with them for 4 years.
I want to give a shout out to my color assistant, Alex Buckland.
Yes, Alex is here.
But when I first sent the first batches of pages for issue 1, Alex's response to me was like, I feel like I can tell you love Ashley so much. And I'm like, yeah, because
it was the same page that I'm like, this is my favorite page.
Yeah, it's. I just, you love these characters, you love the bodies that they're in, and I feel such a responsibility to kind of usher them towards the end.
I think ethically. The love shows on every page. I think this book fucking rocks.
Thank
Congratulations.
You.
Can't wait for issue 4. Make some noise for Josh Corneo and Connor Goldsmith.
Thank you.
You, so
you can pick up Did you hear about Mimi Green in every comic book store worth a damn right now? It's on the floor. You guys have got copies.
Very true. We are selling issue one at our table, D25.
You can get it signed. I got it.
You can get it signed.
And if you need issue two and three, Midtown Comics is like
Midtown Comics has them. So it's like right over there. So just like, and please bring them. We'd love to sign them. We just don't have our comps of three yet, so we didn't bring them.
It looks very
beautiful.
I've got the Mutant Fashion Review now. What have you guys got this weekend? Anything else?
I'm moderating. They asked me to moderate the Queering the Hero panel tomorrow, which is interesting because I'm still not sure like what it is, but I'm going to figure it out. I know most of the people on it, so I'm just like, we're going to vibe, but also like...
I'm on that panel.
Well, yes, Josh is on the panel. Tony's not on the panel. There was some confusion.
I don't know how many fucking GLAAD awards you need to be invited on.
Okay, look.
But whatever.
Point is, we added Josh to the panel, and then I think like the like white gay guy quota.
You don't need another cis man being
sort of like, okay, we've got, it's already a big
throw the seal off the boat.
Anyway.
All right.
Thank you all for coming.
Thank you all.
We love you. And it means so much that people who supported us for talking about other people's shit showed up for our shit. That means a lot. Thank you so much.
X-Men. In the 21st century, people mutants led by Magneto aim to destroy the world. The only hope is X-Men.